Today, we're diving deep into the heart of a legendary saga where dragons don't just hoard treasure, they guard secrets, stories, and the occasional fishing spot. Yes, you heard that right. In the world of Breath of Fire, being a hero means you're part warrior, part dragon, and part-time angler? From pixelated plains to the symphony of 16-bit soundscapes, Breath of Fire isn't just a game. It's a portal to a world where magic is real, fish are plentiful, and your best friend might just be a giant talking frog. So grab your controller and let's set off on a quest not just to save the world, but to discover the heart of what makes this Capcom classic a timeless tale of dragonic proportions. Ready your spells and sharpen your swords. Our journey into Breath of Fire starts now as we take today's trip down memory card lane. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I hope these words find you well. Hello, and welcome to the 188th episode of our video game history podcast, A Trip Down Memory Card Lane. Each week, we'll tell you a story relevant to the current week in gaming history. It can be about a game or the people that created it. It can be about a console or the technology that brought it to life. We often talk about the companies that bring it all together, making our hobby a reality. While telling each story, we hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. Today, we're diving into the mystical world of Breath of Fire, a game that debuted in Japan in 1993 and made its way to North America the following year, introducing players to a unique blend of traditional RPG elements and innovative mechanics. And it's been going on, there's six of them. We'll take a look at the series. I'm David Kasten, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host who, if he were a dragon, would probably breathe out jokes instead of fire. He's my brother, Rob Kasten. Rob, if you were a dragon, what kind would you be?
Oh, Dragon D's, Dave.
Oh, no. No. I love that joke, but no.
Too easy.
Oh, there are some people that listen that are going to love that one. Oh.
Too easy.
That's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Cool. Well, we've established that we're children. So what's up with the current week in gaming history?
Well, Dave, April 4th, 1975, founded by Bill Gates and Paul Allen, Microsoft. The company was initially established to develop and sell basic interpreters for the Altair 8800, which was an early personal computer. It was from these beginnings that Microsoft grew to become one of the largest and most influential technology companies in the world. Played a key role in popularizing personal computing through the development of the Microsoft Windows OS, and later expanded into various other technology sectors, including hardware with the Xbox gaming console.
That's right. A great console. My console of choice these days.
Absolutely, Dave. I don't really play mine, but, you know, I play it more than the PS, so the PlayStation, so.
Cool.
Sticking with the subject of big companies, founded April 1st, 1976, by Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Ronald Wayne, Apple Inc. Apple, Dave. Come on, Microsoft, Apple. Come on. You know they had to have a competitor, and it had to be almost a year later. Not quite, 362 days.
Not quite.
Well, you know, close enough. So for those who don't know, Apple was established with the goal of developing and selling personal computers. The first product they released was the Apple I, a computer designed and hand-built by Steve Wozniak. From the humble beginnings in a garage in Los Altos, California, Apple has grown into one of the largest and most influential tech companies in the world. Known for its innovation in personal computing, smartphone technology, and digital entertainment.
Fartphone?
Fartsmoan, Dave.
Fartsmoan? There's the children in us again. Moving on.
There it is. On April 6, 1990, the sequel to one of the most challenging NES action platformers, Ninja Gaiden 2, The Dark Sword of Chaos, was released. The game was lauded for refining the fast-paced gameplay, intricate level design, and compelling narrative of its predecessor. With the addition of new features such as the ability to cling to walls and summon shadow clones, Ninja Gaiden 2 elevated the series' formula, offering even more depth and challenge. We talked about the original back in episode 27, and learned about historical depictions of ninjas alongside it, so go check it out.
Yeah, that was when I was like, there's got to be a game, and there's got to be something in history. We did all sorts of interesting stuff back then.
Yeah, that we did.
What did we learn about ninjas, do you remember?
That they're cool.
Yeah, that was pretty much it. We did learn that they're cool. Remember, we also learned about that one guy who was puffed his chest up to this guy, was like, oh, I'm the baddest, I'm going to beat you. And then he got taken down in one fell swoop.
Well, isn't such the case with the overconfident?
That's right. Exactly.
Speaking of episodes that we've done in the past, on March 31st, 1998, StarCraft was released by Blizzard Entertainment. This game left its mark on the gaming world with its intricate storytelling, balanced gameplay across three distinct factions, and significant contribution to the esports scene, particularly in South Korea. StarCraft's blend of tactical gameplay, a compelling science fiction story, and a robust multiplayer component has cemented its status as one of the greatest video games of all time. So go check out episode 135, where we talked about all of that and learn about the Zerg Rush.
With a couple friends, I think it's one of our only two guest episodes. We've got two of them.
I think. Yeah, that's. I think that was one of them.
It is, because we had Kiefer and Adam.
Yeah, there. See, you remember. Mm-hmm. And for those that don't know who we're talking about, go listen and you'll see.
Go listen. We hung out with our friends and talked about StarCraft. It was fun.
Yeah, it was. So founded March 31st, 2006, was Bandai Namco.
Bandai Namco.
A result of a merger between two major Japanese entertainment companies, Bandai and Namco.
Go figure.
They were both well-established entities in the entertainment industry, with Bandai being known for toys and Namco for video games. The merger combined Bandai's expertise in character merchandising with Namco's video game development prowess, making Bandai Namco a powerhouse in the global entertainment market.
Yeah, they do a lot of good stuff. Don't they do your Dragon Ball series now?
Oh, man, I'm pretty sure they do, but I would have to double check that. Yeah, I don't know. I don't play them as often as I used to, so it's been a while since I've seen their name. But, you know, it's one of those names that when you see, you're always like, yeah, this will be a pretty good game. Whew. On April 1st, 2003, the gaming and music worlds collide in an extraordinary fusion with the release of Def Jam Vendetta. Featuring a roster of artists from the iconic Def Jam record label, Def Jam Vendetta blended the intensity of wrestling with the rhythm of the streets, offering gamers an experience like no other. Today, it stands as a pioneering title, remembered for its role in bridging the gap between music and interactive entertainment, and leaving a lasting impact on the culture of gaming.
I like Def Jam Vendetta better.
Yeah, Jeff Dam is pretty good.
Jeff Damvada. Def Jam was a phenomenal game. I loved that one. I have it somewhere. So,
I'm sure. It sounded fun. But again, one of those ones that I never played.
Yeah. That's all right.
And Dave, to round it off for our week in gaming history, it was on April 2nd, 2022, that you started playing Chubby Cat.
I started becoming a Chubby Cat, but carry on.
Relatable.
Mm-hmm.
Embracing a delightful blend of puzzle solving and adventure, Chubby Cat offers players an immersive experience as they navigate the cuddly protagonist through a series of inventive and engaging challenges. Celebrated for endearing graphics, captivating gameplay, and heartwarming journey of its rotund feline hero, Chubby Cat stands out as a testament to the joy and creativity that indie games bring to the gaming landscape.
Yeah, Like I said, I'm a chubby kitty.
Agreed. But I don't think people are here to hear about that, Dave.
You sure? So
why don't we kick it into our topic?
You sure no one wants to hear more about Chubby Cat?
I mean, maybe like Chonkers, but
ooh, Chonkers are good.
Yeah.
Big Chonkers. So it's the early 90s, and of course 1990, the Super Nintendo comes out. And so companies at the late 80s, early 90s are looking to make games for the Super Nintendo, right?
Right.
Capcom had a really good run up until now through the arcade and NES era, and they're really looking to capitalize on momentum. You know, they had made so many popular games for the NES. There were licensed titles like DuckTales, Havoc, Stellar, Darkwing Duck, G.I. Joe, Tailspin, loved it. Yo Noid, we talked about that in our advertisement episode. That's the Pizza Hut weird mascot video game. So, you know, they had picked up all these licenses and made all these titles. You know, DuckTales is still loved to this day. They remastered it and re-released it 2020, 2021, somewhere in there. Maybe a little bit sooner. But the point is, I mean, these games are still loved to this day, right?
Right.
And there are plenty of original titles. There was a game called Strider, which we had and I loved. Legendary Wings, the Gold Medal Challenge. And then, of course, there's like hits for the NES, right? Because Capcom created the Mega Man series, which we've done an episode on, and Ghosts and Goblins, which we've done an episode on. And, you know, of course, the list just goes on and on and on for games, you know, popular games that Capcom was making over and over and over. And that's just on the NES side of things, right? They're also seeing a lot of success still in the arcades. 1991 would have been Street Fighter, Street Fighter II era, right? So, I mean, that's the granddaddy of the fighting genre in a lot of ways. You know, we've done a whole episode on that too. So Capcom is firing on all cylinders at this point. They're just going and going and going, and we're moving into the SSS. We're moving into the Super Nintendo era, and of course they're looking for the next big thing. That's how so many of these stories that we do week in, week out start, right? What's the next big thing? And they're looking at the market, right? And they're looking at the success of things they've never done. And of course, one of the things that's not in that library in any way, shape, or form are role-playing games. And role-playing games, you know, particularly, I mean, both in Japan and definitely now over here in the West, were really becoming a thing. You know, thanks to the mid to late 90s, Square's Final Fantasy series, Enix's Dragon Quest series, two, you know, we've done episodes on both of those if you want to check them out. You know, these are all really popular games that people are really starting to like role-playing games, and the market is responding to that. So Capcom is sitting there going, well, maybe we should make a role-playing game, right?
Would make sense.
It makes sense. I mean, you when you're in the market to make money, all you want to do is make money. So if the people are buying role playing games, of course you're gonna make a role playing game. So it's time. Role playing is what they've decided on. Of course, they're gonna kind of pull out their A team, so to speak, to try to capitalize on this market. So right off the bat, they ask Takeru Fujiwara to produce the game. Now, we've discussed him before. He is the creator of Ghosts and Goblins, one of the most historically difficult video games. You know, we did a whole episode on Ghosts and Goblins. And he had also been a producer on the Mega Man team, starting with Mega Man 2, along with so many of the other games that I just listed off, Strider, DuckTales, one of their other big series that we didn't really talk about, Bionic Commando. He was a producer there. you know, he started off as a designer, moved into production. And so he was just, he was a rock star at Capcom at the time. And speaking of rock stars, they also brought Keiji Inafune over as character designer. Now, we've talked about him, too. Inafune had worked on Street Fighter, and he's, like, the guy closely associated with creating Mega Man. Like, he created X, for instance, and did a lot of the character designs of the Robot Masters. And now Inafune and Mega Man, the names, you know, they went hand in hand for years, because starting with, like, well, I don't know, Mega Man 6, if I remember correctly, Inafune was the producer. So he was 6. I think he was through the Mega Man series and into like Battle Legends and all that. So Inafune was Mega Man for a long, long time, right? We've also encountered him later on because he was involved with Dead Rising, and we did a whole episode on Dead Rising, which was the photography zombie survival simulator that I hate and Rob loves.
I wouldn't say I love it.
I knew you were going to say that. So, you know, they bring Fujiwara over and they bring Inafune over, and they basically sit down and design this RPG. Before the game was finished, however, Inafune was pulled off the project and replaced with another character designer. That character designer kept most of Inafune's design choices in his own illustrations. So by and large, Inafune is credited as the creator of all the characters for the Breath of Fire series. So, you know, we have that. And they basically just kind of wanted to do something different, right? You know, they, at Capcom, they brought together those rock stars along with a lot of other talented artists and programmers and designers. But the thing of it is so many of these people were pretty much either working at an RPG for the first time, or they were on the opposite ends. I mean, working on some games for the first time, or they were like seasoned veterans like Inafune or Fujiwara that were just looking to bring their wealth of knowledge to a different genre, right? But it was a lot of people realistically who didn't have experience making an RPG, so it was going to be something new for all of them. So of course they took inspiration from what they already knew, right? So Breath of Fire, for its gameplay, takes from your traditional role-playing games. It has turn-based combat, it has an overworld map with exploration, but they also managed to, like, create some really innovative things, you know? You have a multi-person party, but, like, your lead character could change outside of the battle, and depending on who was head of your party, they had unique abilities that could do different things in the game world. And they kind of used that as a puzzle building mechanic throughout, like a puzzle solving mechanic throughout the game. And then also, like, your main character in the game could turn into a dragon. Like, he could morph into a dragon and had special, like, abilities as a dragon, which was kind of cool. So they tried to, you know, they made the story and everything, and they tried to do something different with it, is kind of the point. You know, they had a lot of talented artists who worked on it. You know, I'm gonna pause right there. I was a fan of Breath of Fire. The first one I'm familiar with because I've played through it. But Breath of Fire 2 is where I was introduced to the series. That was my jam, man. I loved Breath of Fire 2. That game, and we'll get to it because we're going to cover the series. I loved it. So I have experience here. And, like, you know, we've talked about in the past when we've done episodes on, like, Chrono Trigger. Well, we talked about Secret of Mana way in the early part of this podcast, before we were really a history podcast. We were talking about topics, and Secret of Mana came up when we were discussing video games as art, right? The RPGs of this time artistically were special. And that's why a lot of these games are regarded so strongly, and even to this day are looked back as some of the, like, the best video games of all time. Because the art style that people were using in the 16-bit era, in my opinion, it's timeless. Like, these pixel art that these games use, including Breath of Fire, like, they haven't gone out of style. They're never going to go out of style. And so, like, Breath of Fire had beautiful visuals, like colorful sprites, detailed backgrounds. It took place in this, like, unnamed medieval world. Literally, it doesn't have a name. I tried to find a name for it. It doesn't have a name. Medieval world, and they did a really good job bringing it to life. And then, of course, we've discussed the music from that era over and over and over, because there's so many great soundtracks. And this was no different. You know, this one was composed by Hitoshi Sakamoto, among some other artists, but Sakamoto took the helm. And it has a really, like, atmospheric soundtrack that really added to the game. So, I mean, all in all, it didn't reinvent the genre, per se. I mean, there are some things that it did that are unique to this game at the time, but the same can be said for all of them, right? Like, Final Fantasy did something different than Dragon Quest, and Dragon Quest obviously did something different than Breath of Fire. But it didn't really, like, it wasn't anything brand new, mind-blowing, innovative, anything like that. It was just a fantastic addition to the genre. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's okay. You don't always have to do something different. They brought a lot of really great designers and artists and everything together, and those guys took a page out of what was popular at the time, and they made another addition to it that was great. So they released this game, right? You know, it's a Japanese role-playing game made in the early 90s. It's hard to find a lot of stuff on it, if I'm going to be honest with you. But they made this game in 1993, and then 1994, you know, it comes north side. North? It comes north side, Rob. It comes north.
North side.
It comes up north, brother. You know. It comes stateside, right? Comes over to North America. And Capcom had never done RPGs before, right? I mean, we just established that this is their first one. And so they don't have any experience with text-heavy games, role-playing games, games of any kind, really. They just don't have experience with text-heavy games. And so they turned to a company that does, which is really fascinating. And so Capcom USA, the publisher of Breath of Fire, teamed up with Squaresoft, the guys who created Final Fantasy. And Squaresoft, ooh, this is one of the more interesting things about it. Squaresoft actually handled most of the localization and the marketing in North America due to the fact that Capcom USA didn't have a basis in this whatsoever. They don't have the experience doing this. So, you know, Squaresoft at the time put out a North American newsletter. It was called the Ogopogo Examiner, and they featured this game in it. And in their magazine, it was advertised as being from the makers of the Final Fantasy series, since Squaresoft's name was all over it. But really, all they were doing was localization. But it was handed over to, like, experience localization. You know, a guy named Ten Woosley, who we've probably talked about before, because he did Secret of Mana, for instance, and he did Mystic Quest, he did Final Fantasy Legends. Like, he has a lot of localization titles. But yeah, so they handed over to Squaresoft, and Squaresoft takes the helm for localization and basically says, like, hey, it's our game. And that was confusing to some people, right? But they made it work, kinda. There's a lot of, like, abbreviations and weird spell names, and then the plot gets kind of, because they had to just work to fit things in, so it's not perfect. But they made it work, and for a little bit, you know, Breath of Fire came out, and it was a semi-popular role-playing game. I mean, I knew people who played it, but of course I was into role-playing games at the time. But anyways, Rob, you know what else is popular?
What's that, Dave?
Podcasting. I mean, everybody's doing it these days. We're doing it these days, right? 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 So have you, our fellow listeners, do you want to be popular? Have you ever considered making your own podcast? Do you have something clever and engrossing, more clever and engrossing than this? I don't know what is, but there's got to be something out there. Something clever and engrossing that you'd like to share with the world, but you really don't know how? We have just a thing from you. Our friends at Zencastr have created an all-in-one podcasting suite of tools that makes it easier than ever to create your own podcast.
With Zencastr, it's super easy to record a podcast. Everyone logs in using their web browser, and you just start recording a high-quality podcast right away. It allows you to record up to 4K video with your guests, and with Zencastr's multi-layered backups, you always have the highest quality recordings, even if your connection is unstable.
And with Zencastr, you never have to worry about what you sound like. Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound buttery smooth. It automatically removes all those ums and ahs, removes awkward pauses. You can set the right podcast loudness. You can reduce background noise. You can do everything with just the click of a button.
And if the thought of podcasting overwhelms you because you think you need tons of different tools and services, relax. Those days are over. With Zencastr's all-in-one podcasting platform, you can create your podcast, distribute it to multiple places, all from one location.
So, if you'd like to start your own podcast, or maybe you want to take your current podcast to the next level, we've got a deal for you. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use our offer code, all one word, memory card lane, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid platform.
Sign up for Zencastr today, and you can experience the same ease in producing your own high quality podcast as we do each week. Go out and share your ideas with the world.
Share your ideas with the world. And that's just what the people at Capcom had done, right? So, Breath of Fire 1 was released and it was moderately successful. So, they moved on to Breath of Fire 2, which, like I said, Breath of Fire 2 was my jam. Breath of Fire 2 was released in 1994, a year later for the Super Nintendo. It's a direct sequel. The Breath of Fire games are all kind of... It's kind of like The Legend of Zelda in that, like, it's the same characters, but it takes place in a different place, and the storyline is kind of the same, but also different at the same time. Does that make any sense at all?
Sure, Dave.
I mean, if I say it's like The Legend of Zelda, the way they present it, like, do you understand how that might be different than another role-playing, like, another game? Like, Legend of Zelda is unique because it's always Zelda, right? It's always Link, and it's always, you know, the man of legend going against the villain of legend type deal, right? That's
well, that all makes sense, yeah.
So that's the way it was. Like, you're always Rue. You're always, like, ability to shift into a dragon. The place doesn't always stay the same, and the bad guy doesn't always stay the same, but the basis of it kind of has stayed the same through the entire series. So it's a very similar concept to that, to where, like, it's Breath of Fire, right?
Yeah, okay.
But as the series grew, so too does everything about it, if that makes sense. Like, from Breath of Fire 2, you now have a whole slew of experienced people, you know, or people that can give their opinion that are experienced. So everything about it kind of matures. You know, if the original story was just and it was very straightforward, linear story. Breath of Fire 2 was just a more intricate narrative. It had more emotional depth. It had more mature themes. It dealt with religion. It dealt with corruption. There was an identity crisis. Like, it matured a lot. In order for that to happen, of course, you have to have more diversity in your characters, right? So there are more characters, and they now have a backstory, and you had personal quests that now, like, intertwine with the main storyline. And of course, we've talked about that before, you know, role-playing games that do that, like my favorites, right? Chrono Trigger, Final Fantasy VII, they do a really great job of doing side quests where you have to learn about your party members in those side quests, you know? And that was one thing that Breath of Fire 2 did that was very different from the first, that from the first one. And because of this, you know, this addition, this depth to it, the sequel, Breath of Fire 2, put a whole, like, more greater emphasis on character development and party dynamics, you know, in terms of the combat system and things like that. You know, the combat system kind of grew up, so it was more refined. You had better inventory management. You now had these special abilities called Shaman Fusions, where you could merge with these things called shamans, obviously, and, like, really powerful transformations the same way you do a dragon, just upped another level. So there were some fun additions to the system. And of course, like, your artists now know how to work with the Super Nintendo better. So there's no doubt that Breath of Fire 2 just looks better. The backgrounds are prettier. The character sprites are better. The environments are just richer. It's just they now know how to make a game on the Super Nintendo to just deliver a better looking game. And then they had some other fun features. No surprise, I like city building, right? We know this at this point in my life, correct?
I'd say so.
So Breath of Fire 2 has the ability to build and develop a township. You can actually invite NPCs to come to there who all, like, you know, I don't remember all of the top of my head. It's been a long time, but the examples, like, here's a blacksmith, here's a priest, you know, upgrade equipment, upgrade your spells type deal. So your town, you know, you invited people to your township, and that's how you also grew as a person. But not everything about Breath of Fire 2 was a step forward, right? The original Breath of Fire was localized, as we said, by Square Enix, but Capcom kept localization for Breath of Fire 2, thinking they could do it better, but they did not. They did not at all. It's notoriously a rushed translation. It has led to, it's one of the games that gets mocked for bad translations. There's confusing dialogue, there's crappy plot points. Some people hated it, some people liked it. There have been re-releases of most of these game early games, and they fixed it. So if you play, like, a modern one off of, you know, like, the marketplaces, you won't find that. But the original one has some quirks to it, for sure. Right?
Sure.
Sure? Have you ever even heard of Breath of Fire before?
Nope, not a one.
Not a single Breath of Fire in any way, shape, or form?
Nope.
So the series moved on from Breath of Fire 2 in 1997, like everyone else that made the transition, because 95, 94, 95 would have been the PlayStation. No doubt that Capcom was going to take Breath of Fire into the 3D era onto the PlayStation. So 1997, Breath of Fire 3 gets released for the PlayStation, and again, you go from one generation of video games, right, to another, and there are just significant advancements across the board. Graphics are better, gameplay is better, the narrative changes. It moves to a whole new generation, and it's obvious that it's a next generation Breath of Fire, which was a really good thing. You know, they take the 2D sprites, that beautiful artwork from the previous ones, and I may not be as much of a fan of the 3D, but the new ones are 3D. They moved to polygonal 3D. So more immersion. But the environments were in 3D, but the characters were sprite-based. It was a unique art style that was really kind of cool, and I liked that about it. They took the fusions, and they kind of made this thing called the Master System, which is not the fusions, but Master System basically allowed you to become an apprentice under masters. What else? So you could become an apprentice and learn new skills and abilities from the master, right? So you could technically customize your character, customize classes, and not play it the same way every time. You know, it that's more of a modern aesthetic, right? Where you can, you know, I mean, Skyrim, you love Skyrim. Skyrim does something similar where you can only learn certain skills if you want. I guess Skyrim, you can learn all the skills, can't you?
Yeah, yes. I'm pretty sure you can.
Have you ever maxed out your Skyrim character?
Not with everything, God, no.
I mean, it's only been around for like 14 years, actually 13 years.
Yeah, but that takes a lot of land.
So you had the Master System, and you could learn things and apprentice things underneath a master. And then they added to the combat system. They now had gene splicing, where you could splice in different dragon genes that would let you transform into different dragon forms, and every dragon form had its own unique ability. So that was fun. And of course, when you build a 3D immersive environment, you add things to it, right? That's one thing that this era saw in video games. This is the era when we moved over to the PlayStation and we moved over to the 3D polygon era. We essentially moved into the large open world immersive era, right? Like Grand Theft Auto 3 moved us into that era. And what else was a good PlayStation example that moved us into the open world? That's probably the best example out there.
Yeah, probably.
But someone's going to kick me and get on me for forgetting all of them. But the point is when we got into that era, you know, open world, immersive worlds was a thing. So this was no different, right? You now had interactive environments. You could interact with objects. There were all these mini games. There was a fishing mini game. Everybody loves fishing, don't they? You love fishing.
Got that right.
We end up playing fishing in like everything we play, don't we?
Yeah.
Including
if it's the thing, we do it.
Including fishing games. Like we literally have just played fishing games before, which cracks me up. We got to get back to the Call of the Wild fishing game.
Yeah, got that right.
That was peaceful. So, I mean, they basically took everything and moved Breath of Fire into the 3D era, right? With a big expansive world and all the perks that come with big and fancy and more expansive. And then a few years later in 2000, Breath of Fire 4 comes out. And Breath of Fire 4, again, it's the second game in a generation. So everything that they learned about making the game for Breath of Fire 3 on the PlayStation, they were able to up it for Breath of Fire 4. It is graphically even more beautiful, better sprites, better 3D backgrounds. Just, I mean, that comes as no surprise because you learn when doing, and they definitely knew better then. But most unique about this one is it has two main characters. It has a dual narrative structure. And so it's not just Rue, the guy you're used to. There's another character named Fulu. And they just kind of intertwine their story. They're telling a similar story from two different perspectives that kind of weave in and out of one another. And of course, they change a little bit of everything. There's a combo system for the turn, that dragon transformation, the gene splicing mechanic. They refined that. You could merge dragon genes to create new dragon forms, to get new dragon abilities, new transformations. No surprise there. And Breath of Fire 4 is also one of the more mature games in the series. You know, you're dealing with power and the consequences of war. So there is a story that has a lot of emotional depth and moral complexity. And then, of course, 2001 would have been the introduction of the PlayStation 2. So we're moving into a new generation of games, right? And right. Here we have the most recent entry in the Breath of Fire series, which we're going to talk about it and why. Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter. It was a 2002 Japanese release and 2003 North American release. Now, Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter is not like the other Breath of Fire games. It deviates drastically from the rest in the series. First of all, it's the first game in the series to be full 3D. No more half 2D sprites, half 3D. So, you know, you're controlling your characters from a third person perspective, through the overworld, through dungeons and towns. And it's not fantasy anymore. All of the other Breath of Fire games are like medieval fantasy dragon based worlds. And the dragon didn't go away, but this game takes place in a series of bunkers 1,000 meters below the surface in like a post-apocalyptic environment. So basically you're going from bunker to bunker through these network of tunnels, like in a post-apocalyptic world, you know, collecting keys and defeating enemies and finding treasure. And I mean, there's a story, but you get the point. Like, they completely
Fallout with dragons.
It's kind of a Fallout with dragons, but like, they just dropped it, right? You've got four games that are all the same, you know, I mean, not the same, but, you know, fantasy environment with, you know, overworld. And suddenly, like, now we're underground in bunkers. We're not even overworld anymore. Like, we completely got rid of everything about the fantasy and the overworld and everything. Like, we're underground in a post-apocalyptic, you know what I'm trying to say. World?
Yep.
That's exactly what I was trying to say. And then it's not a traditional turn-based RPG anymore. So it has this really unique blend of a tactical turn-based system combined with some real-time action elements. They called it that there was like the scenario overlay system. You could restart the game. That's more so. That's not really the combat. The scenario overlay system is where you could restart the game at, like New Game Plus. You'd get to a certain point in the game with like characters and items and character progression, and then you could restart the game and play through scenarios over again because they wanted to like encourage multiple playthroughs to fully uncover the story. So I got a little bit ahead of myself there. But like, it was basically a tactical like RPG and not old school traditional turn-based one. So not only did they get rid of the fantasy motif, but they got rid of like the fact that it was a traditional role-playing series. It was more, it had like active points, so it was more like Final Fantasy's active battle system, but not quite full action like theirs is. It was this weird blend between the two. So yeah, you know, they got rid of it. And like I said, it was fully 3D. It, like, their art style is more like stylized and cel shaded. So like, they completely got rid of the sprite based character models and the nice 3D polygonal background. And I mean, it's got a more, I mean, cel shaded, for lack of a better word, it's like cartoony look to it, you know?
Oh.
And then like, when you get rid of an open world and you put yourself underground in tunnels and bunkers, like, you lose the openness of it. So one of the big criticisms for this game is that it's more focused and linear because it emphasizes survival and emphasizes escaping a claustrophobic underground setting. And so, like, everything is just more claustrophobic, including the story. Like, it's like everything that people liked about the Breath of Fire series until then, they threw it into the trash can and said, we're going to do something different. That's really it.
And how'd that play out?
Well, that's a fantastic, fantastic question. And the answer is not very good.
That can't be surprising to many.
Yeah, that not very good at all.
I mean, especially considering that it was the last entry in the series, and how long ago was that?
Yeah, 2002, 2003, so 20 years now.
It's quite a long time, so I think that this was the nail in the coffin for the series. Sometimes these bold changes can prove good, but, you know, when you try to do too much at one time and just completely make it a different game, you're just making a new game and slapping an old name on it, hoping people enjoy it. And that can leave a bad taste.
And it left the bad taste in this case. To kind of answer your question with more evidence, so to speak, there are first year sales numbers through a Japanese publication, like on the Japan side of things, where this series is probably more popular anyways. I don't know how the original Breath of Fire did, but Breath of Fire 2 sold 350,000 copies its first year. Breath of Fire 3 sold 425,000 copies its first year.
Nice.
Breath of Fire 4 sold 334,000 copies, so still moderately successful, right? They're all kind of in line with one another. And then Dragon Quarter sold 140,000.
Wow, that sucks.
Yeah.
That's a shooty, bad time.
But critically, it did okay. Like, Breath of Fire 3, Famitsu gave it a 28. You know, we talked about them giving perfect scores recently to Vagrant Story. That's where Famitsu came up recently. You know, they got a 28 for 3. Breath of Fire 4 got a 31. And Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter got a 32. So from the, like, critic and game standpoint, the critics liked it. From the person standpoint, Game Rankings has Breath of Fire 4 at 82% and Breath of Fire Dragon Quarter at a 78%. So it's not like it was hated. It just 140,000 copies. And when you're in the business of making money, that's just not going to cut it, you know?
No, that does not quite do it, Dave. You need to do a little better than that.
So yes. So Breath of Fire, no more entries in it since 2003. Honestly, there hasn't really been any, like, in 2008, 2009, they were asked about it, and they were basically like, nah, we don't have any plans for any future of the series, because, I mean, nobody was asking for it. You've seen some things, like, there are appearances of Breath of Fire characters in other Capcom games over the years. I mean, as recently as 2021. So, I mean, they at least, you know, have brought the characters back, but there's really nothing. I don't know if there's any hope. I mean, someone will probably make another Breath of Fire someday, but at the moment, we got nothing, you know?
Well, sometimes it'd be like that, Dave.
Yep. And then pretty much everyone involved with this game we've talked about in other episodes. You know, Fujiwara worked sporadically, but came back to, they redid Ghosts and Goblins 2021, I think, and they did Bionic Commando Rearmed a few in 2020. So Fujiwara is back and helping with some remasters of his old games. And then Inafune did Mega Man for a long time and then left Capcom, did Mighty No. 9, which failed. We kind of talked about that. And then he's got his own company. He's currently listed as a producer on Fantasy Life 1, The Girl Who Steals Time, with the 2024 release.
So, that sounds like a good game right there.
So, I mean, like, this is just a game. Like, I do it because I like to mix it up, right? I like to introduce people to games and things that they may have never experienced before. So Breath of Fire 2, in my opinion, is still, like, peak mid-90s role-playing. You know, if you're going to play the Chrono Triggers and Secret of Mana's and that in the world, for me, I think Breath of Fire 2 should be on the list. It's fantastic. Great story, great world. The town part is fun. The shamans are fun. Like, just go play it. It's fantastic. But otherwise, Breath of Fire hasn't made a dent, an impact, anything. It is a credit on a lot of important people's resume. That's pretty much what it's done. You know?
Hey, that's something, though.
That's okay. Those people did a lot of other interesting stuff. You know, Inafune, for instance, like we said, Mighty No. 9, and most importantly, the Mega Man series. And of course, we've done a whole episode on the beginning of the Mega Man series and his involvement with much of the series. So if you'd like to go check it out, you can, of course, go check out old episodes on our website. It's www.memorycardlane.com. And Rob, what else can people do on our website?
Well, Dave, people can find a calendar of our future episodes. Maybe give us a little bit of knowledge you have about a game that or topic we're going to talk about. Or maybe just tell us how you feel about it. We're always interested to learn new things, even if it's just how people received certain things. You can find a link to our Discord where you can come talk to Dave and I about whatever fancies your pickle or whatever you got there. That was weird. I don't know. You can find a link to our Patreon where you can help support us and get access to ad-free and unedited versions of our episodes. And you can find a link to our social media where I am on several platforms as Rob_O_Raptor and Dave.
I can be found on various platforms as David is wrong. Each week, we tell you a story about one topic relevant to the current week in gaming history. This week, 1993, 31 years ago, that is, right?
Yeah.
The Breath of Fire series was released to the world in the original Breath of Fire. Well, we teach you these topics. We hope to teach you something new about the topic, what it took from the world as its inspiration, or what it gave back to the world in its legacy. And one of the best parts about getting to do this is every week when we sit down to do research for every episode, we always end up learning things. Can't know everything. So the research, I get to learn things. That's my favorite part about doing this. And then in turn, I get to teach y'all things. So teaching, learning, that's what I'm here for. In recognition of how awesome that is, we like to go round table and talk about our takeaways. So, Rob, what did you learn today?
Well, obviously I learned all about this game, having known really nothing about it before. But I think that the coolest part about it is, for such a game that I knew nothing about, to know that this is kind of where it started, the whole changing your lead character outside of battle to have unique abilities to proceed in the game world. I mean, there's a lot of games that I play like that. I mean, most notably comes to mind of recent games I played, despite it being old, is the South Park Fractured But Whole. And that's one of the things, is you have to have certain characters to perform certain actions in the game world. And it's crazy to think that something like that started way back in the 90s.
What, buttholes?
So it's, yeah, fractured buttholes. So, you know, it's just, it's cool to know that. And again, for not having known anything about this game, it's just, it's cool to know that it had such an impact on games as a whole. And, you know, although maybe it's not something that I will enjoy playing, it's something that I can enjoy learning about and appreciating.
I'd say you'd enjoy playing it, but you don't. We've covered that, like, multiplayer games are your thing, so a nice long role-playing game is probably not on your list.
Well, you never know, Dave. We'll see. So, that's it for me. What's your big takeaway from this week?
The people involved. You know, I obviously played this when I was a teenager and really enjoyed at least the second one in the series and had a lot of fun with it. But who pays attention, at least when you're a kid, to stuff like that? I had no clue who made this. I didn't know that the characters were originally designed by the guy from Mega Man. I didn't know that the guy who created Ghosts and Goblins, you know, produced the original game in the series. I didn't know. So finding out, you know me, I like pedigree. I like learning people's resumes and adding notches to it and learning all the ways that people took experience from one game and learned to make another. So adding this to their resume is always fun for me. That's my takeaway.
A good one indeed.
Well, on that note, I think we've done it, and we can probably take it out of here. So before I go into next week, is there anything else that you'd like to add to today's episode?
Well, Dave, as always, I want to take one quick moment to say thank you so much to all of our listeners. It means the world to us to have you here, and we hope you know that we appreciate you joining us. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with that. All right. Awesome. Fantastic. We've done it. Yay. Woo! So that wraps up our journey through the mystical realms and fiery battles of Breath of Fire. From the heroic endeavors of Rue to the rich lore that spans across all the sequels in the Breath of Fire series, we've kind of covered the whole legacy of the Breath of Fire franchise that has carved its own little niche into the RPG genre. Memorable characters, engaging storylines, and this cool ability to transform into dragons has left Breath of Fire leaving its own like mark on the heart of gamers. So as we close the book on Rue's adventures, we're going to take a look forward into a new chapter filled with suspense and mystery. Ooh. Next week, Rob, we're going to delve into the shadowy corridors and unsettling mysteries of Amnesia. You ever played any of the Amnesia games?
Can't say that I have, Dave.
So prepare to explore the dark depths of the mind in a game that redefined horror for the digital age, with its gripping narrative and innovative gameplay mechanics that play on the primal fears of darkness and amnesia. The original Amnesia is literally a cornerstone for the horror gaming genre. So keep the lights on and brace yourself for an episode that promised to be as enlightening as it is terrifying, as we take another trip down memory card lane. Do the thing.
Doobie doobie bop and bop and bop and boo.